It's 115 in Phoenix today. Yeah, you cheer because you're here. So I like Michigan a lot. You know one thing, though, that when it's 115 out that you don't have? Mosquitoes. You don't have those. I forgot about those. Minnesota? Man, state bird. They're giant. They're like, they're crazy. So glad to be back. Those of you who were not here with us last week, I was guest teaching as well. I get to do it again today. I'm very excited. We are actually in the second week of a series that you all are doing. This is a series on spiritual practices. So I am finishing out my time with you, but I'm actually only in the second week of something you all are doing. Last week, I was invited to come and teach on fasting, which I went ahead and neglected. And I taught instead on feasting, and I hope that some of you had a chance to do some of that this week. This week, I will be obedient and teach on what I was asked to teach on. And this practice they asked me to teach on was one of these practices that is completely unnatural to me as a human. Something about my personality resists it at all cost, and so... It's been a hard practice over the years for me to do, and yet it has become probably the most transformative thing that has opened me to God in ways that nothing else ever has. And so as a consequence, I have tended to this practice the way you might tend to a newborn infant, this incredibly fragile but powerful thing that needs to be cared for. And so I love this practice. I've grown to love it. In my tradition... I'm a Mennonite. That's the church I'm a part of and pastoring in Phoenix. And in the Mennonite tradition, for many, many years, their whole way of orienting faith was around this idea of following Jesus. I know that sounds radical. but there actually is a difference. A lot of Christian traditions throughout history thought about believing in Jesus was kind of the main thing you do. But the Mennonites have always understood this following. And the way they've understood it, which has become more and more popular, is this very earthy following, like Jesus put his foot there, you put your foot there. And so it becomes this sort of simple, ethical way of living in the world. You follow what Jesus did, how he actually behaved. And this is wonderful. I'm thrilled by it. I think it's been extremely helpful to many, many people. There is one part, though, of following Jesus that I think gets missed, that kind of gets skipped over. And it's understandable because there's not a lot in the Bible about this. There is some, but it's tucked away in weird places. This is basically learning to follow the spiritual practice of Jesus, not just the ethics of Jesus, the spirituality of Jesus. So if you were to actually read these passages, the reason they're hard to find is that they're kind of used by the gospel writers as little parenthetical asides. Little statements are kind of thrown in there, and then they move on to something much, much more interesting. And so, but if you actually find the verses, which they're a little bit, they're easy to skip over. They're like a rose in a cornfield. You know, they're not that easy to see. But when you pick out these roses, you can create a little beautiful bouquet, and you can begin to see the theme of the way that Jesus began to practice spiritual practices. So let's begin with our passages this morning. Just a few we're going to go through real quickly. Mark chapter 135. Very early in the morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, left the house, and went off to a solitary place. Luke 4:42. At daybreak, Jesus went out to a solitary place. Mark 6:46. After leaving them, he went up on a mountainside to pray. Matthew 14:13, when Jesus heard what had happened, he withdrew by boat privately to a solitary place. And Luke 5:16, but he would withdraw to deserted places. This last one is, everything else was past tense, Jesus did something, but this last one, the actual verb, is a present continual verb, meaning he would repeatedly do this. He would withdraw to solitary places. And one of the things that Jesus is doing, this whole point of solitude, is actually because he's after something else, which is silence. This is what Jesus was after. He would go into the wilderness for silence. And the reason we know this is because this is what the traditions have always taught And Jesus had understood this, and so he would find a way to go into the wilderness. Now, this wasn't just about external silence. This was also about finding internal silence. So there's a both going on here. Now, the tradition this comes from, back in the book of 1 Kings, Elijah was a prophet. And he had this experience where he was trying to do what God was asking him to do. He had this miserable, horrible, awful, no good, very bad time. And he basically wandered into the wilderness looking for God. And there on this mountain, a giant wind came through and it rent the mountain and destroyed all the mountains around him. And after the wind came, the Lord was not in the wind. And then right after that, there was this huge earthquake and everything began trembling and shaking. And then after the earthquake, the Lord was not in the earthquake. And then in 1 Kings chapter 19, verse 12, it says, "And after the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a small, still voice." A small, still voice. And after the fire, a small, still voice. And right after this, in this passage, Elijah covers his face, falls to the ground, and he actually hears God for the first time. So he found God in this place. Now, the interesting thing about this passage is the translators have used small, still voice, which is fine, you can do that. But the actual Hebrew does not use the word voice anywhere. So in fact, if you do a more literal translation of what the Hebrew is saying, it is actually a gentle stillness. Afterwards, a gentle stillness. So what that means is that in Elijah's pursuit of God, when he's looking for God in the wind and the earthquake and the fire, God is nowhere to be found in the spectacle. God is to be found in this gentle stillness. And this is what Jesus repeatedly practiced, finding gentle stillness. So, with someone like me, with my personality, I'm an extrovert. I like being with people, and I do a lot of talking. Obviously, that's part of my job. So, the idea of going and being still and alone and quiet never made much sense to me. And like, I could get my head around, like, okay, I'm going to go have my quiet time. But quiet time was mostly, like, reading the Bible, praying, journaling, doing something like that. No, 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 this is talking about something different. This is talking about sitting and not accomplishing anything. Not actually doing anything. Just being. So none of this made sense to me until I left advertising. So some of you know that I used to work in advertising. And I had this very overwhelming clarity, this sense that I was no longer supposed to do that anymore. But I was not told what I was supposed to do after that. And so I left advertising and I went to seminary. Which is, I guess, what you do when you don't know what you're doing in life. So any of you out there who are kind of wondering what's next, the answer is seminary. Always. It's that simple. So anyway, I go to seminary, and for 3 years, I'm trying to sort out what it is I'm supposed to do. And I went and met with counselors and psychologists, and I met with mentors and supervisors and all kinds of different people to try and help me get this stuff. I went through these personality inventories. I took career counseling tests. I did all kinds of things. In fact, one of them, there I am 3 years into seminary after I've left the world behind, and one of the first things on the list of things that I should be involved in the career counseling, guess what? Advertising, right. I'm like, woohoo, thank you, Jesus. So that was unfortunate. So I basically hit the wall. I'm like, I can't seem to find what it is I'm supposed to do, and I'm sitting there trying to sort all of this out. And I stumbled upon a spiritual teacher, a spiritual director, who was a retired pastor of 30 years, and she lived in a Quaker retirement community. And when I went to meet with her the first time, what I learned very quickly is that she had absolutely no interest in all the stuff I was asking. Like, I wanted to know, like, okay, I've got this and this, I'm good at this, but I'm not very good at this, and I want to understand this, maybe I should do this, And she didn't bite at all. She just kind of sat there and listened. And after a little while, she informed me that the way she likes to operate is when we come together, we sit in silence together. I'm like, awesome. That's just what I want to do because I love silence. And so we would learn, we would practice this together. We would sit together for the first 10 or 15 minutes of our time together in silence together. And it was very odd. It wasn't awkward, but it was odd for me. And I started to kind of learn how to anchor in her silence. And then she would give me different instructions and ways of sort of techniques to help me practice silence on my own. That was the only thing she was after. And she was convinced that she said, the answer to your question you will not get by looking out there. Your only way to get this answer is going within and practicing silence. And so I started doing this. And over the course of about a year of practicing this silence regularly, and it was brutal for me. I mean, I could last 5 minutes and then I'd be like, whew, okay, I'm done with that. Oh, that was great. Awesome. Okay, now I can talk again and think. And so it took a while for me to kind of get into this rhythm, but something astonishing happened in this process. And the best way I can describe what actually happened is through a metaphor. Some of you have had this experience, I'm sure. The other day I'm driving along, and I am in an area that I'm unfamiliar with. I've got some directions, and I'm looking for a particular sign that I'm trying to, you know, turn onto a particular street. And as I'm driving along, I'm blasting some tunes. I've got like a big subwoofer in my Prius, and that's just how I roll. So I know many of you are jealous. Subwoofer in the Prius. Nobody does that. Anyway, and I'm of course rocking out to Yanni or something awesome like that. And Yanni threw these big subwoofers, kill them. I'm driving along, and as I'm approaching what I think might be the area I need to turn, I lean forward and I reach for the stereo and I turn the volume down. How many of you ever done this? Yes, that should be all of you, by the way. Any of you who hasn't raised your hand are lying or lazy. Anyway, so you turn the volume down. Now, why would I or any of us do this? Why do we do this? What does an acoustic sense, an acoustic stimulant, have to do with a visual stimulus? How are these connected? Did you just say rain or the brain? The brain, yeah, very true, thank you. That's Captain Obvious, that's good. I've got more of that coming, good. So one of the reasons this happens is because the brain and the human senses draw from a finite pool of resources. There's a limited number of resources. So what that means is when you overstimulate one sense, you begin to draw resources from the other senses, and you dull the awareness of those senses. So this is why turning the radio down actually diverts resources to the visual sense so that you have more acuity in order to see the turn that you're about to make. This is exactly what the practice of silence does. It turns the radio down. It turns the inner monologue of the mind down long enough that you can look for signs of God. And this is exactly what happened to me. The more that I learned to turn down the mind and the inner monologue, the more I made space and developed attentiveness to the movement and the voice of God. Now, I want to be clear, this isn't an auditory voice. It wasn't for me visions and sounds. It was an inner feeling, an awareness of exactly what I was supposed to do. And it wasn't actually about what I was supposed to do. I discovered who I was, who God made me to be. And once I discovered that, I stopped asking all the questions. And what I learned I was made to be was a pastor. And then my task was to just accept this curse, of course. Some of you think I'm kidding. No, it's wonderful. So, That makes sense. Are you with me? So one of the purposes and the values of silence, and I mean this now, any of you in this room who are, or anyone listening, who is wondering what they should be doing in this life, what I can tell you from my own experience is that silence is an extremely powerful practice to help you uncover the thing God made you for. But that is not the main point of silence. It is not only about establishing or finding your direction. There's more to silence than that. And it's actually found in our passages that I just read to you, each one of those verses that I kind of cherry-picked out of the Bible and then collected them together. If you actually read those verses in context, you'll find something really fascinating. Something incredibly remarkable happens immediately after each of those moments of withdrawing to deserted places. Immediately after one, Jesus comes back and walks on water. Immediately after another, Jesus comes back and feeds 5,000. Immediately after another, Jesus heals a blind man. Immediately after another, he heals a man who couldn't walk. Immediately after another, Jesus comes and drives out demons. Every single time Jesus withdrew to quiet places, Jesus comes back to do the most astonishing, incredible, extraordinary acts of kingdom activity. The gospel writers, this is not an accident. They pair these things deliberately and intentionally. They want us to see that there is an intimate connection between Jesus withdrawing to quiet places and Jesus enacting God's shalom in the world. They are intimately and inextricably bound together. And the exact same thing is true of us. In Phoenix, where I live, when I first arrived in Phoenix, I discovered something very interesting about the nature of the city. When you walk out into the backyard of your brand new home, what you'll discover is a kind of a sweeping vista view of a 6-foot gray concrete block wall. And it's really lovely if you like prisons. It's a very kind of like, oh, that's serious. And so a lot of people in Phoenix, when they see this block wall, they try to make it look a little prettier. And so we did that. We hired a landscape architect to come out and beautify this backyard. And Phoenix is kind of an arid place. You may be familiar with it. It's the desert. And so you get about 18 to 20 minutes of rain a year. And so what you do is you have to install a water line, a drip line, in order to have plants flourish or survive. So we had these 5 or 6 bushes installed along this curving block wall that we had to kind of cover them up. And right after they'd been installed, all of them worked great, except one of them began to have brown little tips on the leaves. And then over time, I'm a little slow on the draw, they turned completely brown, and then pretty quick it was just like a collection of sticks jutting out of the ground. And I'm quick, so I figured out something must be wrong. So I go over and I inspect the situation. What they do is they bury a hose beneath the ground that connects to the water source. It's about 1 foot beneath the ground in front of the plants. And then they bring a little 1/4-inch line from that main hose all the way up to the surface of the soil that's positioned just at the base of the plant. And then it can drip just a little bit of water out, just enough to keep these things alive. So when I went to inspect, I turned on the water and I went and checked, and sure enough, the line to that plant wasn't dispensing water. And so what I had to do was, obviously it may have been clogged or something, because that can happen when you're installing this stuff, dirt's everywhere. So what we did is I dug down to find the original source. I'd have to detach it and somehow clean it out in order to get the water out. So I begin digging, and as I'm digging, I notice that I'm digging back towards the wall, and I know that the line, the original water source, is in front. So I'm like, this is curious. So as I'm digging, I get to the end of this line, somewhere 1 foot beneath the earth, and it's just sitting in the dirt. This is not useful for watering plants. So literally, they must have just installed it and like forgotten to attach it or something. So here I had this thing, this little 1/4-inch line that was absolutely perfectly placed above the soil. Everything was great. It was there to provide water. Everything was fine, with the exception of the simple fact that it was not connected to the source. And as a consequence, it's, of course, useless. Every time Jesus withdraws to quiet places, that is his way of connecting to the source of life. Before he tries to offer life, he connects to the source of life. And that is the same with us. If you want to serve the world, if you want to bless the world, if you want to bring about justice, peace, healing, hope, whatever it is you want to bring, if you yourself personally are not connected to the source, you will be very hard-pressed to do much of anything. A light bulb can be the highest wattage light bulb ever, and if it doesn't connect with the electricity, it's just glass and metal. It will not give light. Does this make sense? Okay, good. Now, one of the questions that I was left with when I first started discovering some of this stuff is, what is the relationship between silence and this connection? How does silence help you establish the connection to the source of life? The reason that silence is so crucial is because this connection I'm talking about is fundamentally an experience of the heart, not a concept, an idea, or a philosophy of the mind. This experience is not an idea. This connection is not an idea. It is an experience. And as a result, the mind, the intellect, our words, our thoughts, our ideas, our concepts, and our philosophies have no access to the experience of this connection. They have no access to this connection. The mind will not serve you in that connection. Now, it doesn't make it invalid. The mind is a beautiful thing. It's extremely effective. It's very, very powerful. I love the mind. I love the intellectual life. I love to read and think and pray and do all that stuff. But it has limits. This connection is found in the heart, and the language of the heart is silence. That is the way we experience this connection. Let me try think of it this way. A week ago, if you were here, you all had a chance to eat chocolate with us. We all ate chocolate together. I think I heard a woo back there. That was great. What if none of us had ever eaten chocolate before in our life? We'd never known what it had tasted like. And so I brought in a master poet. And he gave you like an hour-long explanation of these brilliant silver-tongued words on exactly how chocolate tastes. And then right after that, I got a historian in here, and the historian came up, and he gave you the history of chocolate and all the ways that it has changed throughout history and the parts of the country and the world that chocolate comes from and how it's made and all that good stuff. And then after that, I got a scientist up here, and he showed you exactly the way in which your taste buds fire in such a way that they activate neural pleasure sensors in the brain, and that's why chocolate tastes so good. And then after that, I showed you a bunch of really, really, really beautiful pictures of chocolate so you could see what chocolate looks like if you hadn't ever seen it before. And then finally, I bring up a bunch of people on this stage, and I get them to tell you all the ways that eating chocolate changed their life. At the end of all that, 4 hours or so that would take, you would still have only an idea, only a concept, only a philosophy of what chocolate tastes like. You wouldn't actually know what it tastes like. The only way you'll know what it tastes like is if you let it touch your tongue. The brain was not made for tasting. It was made for thinking. The mind was made for thinking. Silence, the practice of silence, is like the tongue. It allows you to taste and know, not just think and believe. That's why the mind doesn't have access to this thing. It isn't made that way. Now, to say all that doesn't mean that the mind is irrelevant. The mind plays a crucial role in the life of the spiritual practitioner. Coming to teachings, reading your Bible, praying, thinking, journaling, reading books, whatever, all of that is beautiful, it's valuable, it's really, really helpful, but it won't get you to the experience. And I want to be clear on this relationship between your mind and this experience, because it's an important one. And the best way for me to describe that relationship is through the help of a volunteer. So here's what we're going to do. I am looking for anyone in here who plays football, particularly a quarterback. Does anybody in here, have you ever at one time in your life, or are you currently a quarterback in football? Anyone? Raise your hand. Give me hands. Raise them up real high. I'm seeing you, sir. Come on up. Big round of applause. What is your name?
John.
This is John, everybody. Give it up for John. You just did. John, where do you are you currently playing football?
No, I played in high school.
What did you play in high school? You were a quarterback? Okay, who did you play for? What was your team?
Comstock Colts.
Excuse me?
Comstock Colts.
Comstock Colts. Anybody here a Colts fan? Are you serious? That's ridiculous and humiliating. I'm a fan. I'm a fan. Thank you. Okay, here's what I want you to do, John. John is a seasoned expert football player. He spent many, many, many hours refining the mechanics and the muscles in his arm so that he can throw a football. So what I need is a receiver of some kind, preferably in this section. Anyone? It doesn't have to be this section, but whoever the receiver is, someone with good hands, I need you to go back there to those doors. Wow. Come on now, receiver. Boom, right there. Yes, sir, you. I invite you to stand up. Make your way back. See, did you guys see that? The spring in the step? That was great. Okay, so I want you to stand back there. I want you to be ready to receive a pass from our good friend, John. Now, John, here, you can do whatever you got to do if you need to kind of back up a little bit. Here's what I want you to do. I want you to just sort of demonstrate for us what many, many hours of practice gets you in throwing a ball. Now, you don't have to, it doesn't have to be amazing. You don't have to, blow him against the back wall or anything. You just a pretty good arc and a reasonable spiral is kind of what we're looking for. And I want you all to pay very, very close attention to John's throw. Pay attention not only to the mechanics of the throw, but actually what the ball does in the air. And then you'll catch it. Whenever you're ready, let the Spirit lead you. Oh, yeah! Oh, man! That was awesome. That was fantastic. That was better than I expected. Well done. No offense, but, you were fantastic. That was great. Okay, I also played football. You'll be happy to know. I was very slow. I have bad hands, kind of concrete blocks. I had no real arm. And so usually what happens when you're in that situation and you'd like to play football, they put you on what's called the line. You guys familiar with this? Offensive line. I think I was right guard. I was also not very big. So usually what happens then is your third string is what they call that position. Or bench warmer, another position I was intimately familiar with. So I played football until junior year, from fourth grade to junior year, until I figured out, I'm no good at this. Why do I do this to myself? I love for the love of the game. So what I'm going to do now is show you, and I'm going to throw, I'm right-handed, but I'm going to throw with my left hand. And I'm going to show you, I want you to see the difference between a refined, muscular, well-coordinated arm and a weak, uncoordinated, not so good arm, and pay attention both to my form, how beautiful or really ugly it looks, and then also what the ball does in the air. You're going to need to come closer. Honestly, I think I can kick a spiral better than what I'm about to do. Okay, so, right? This is it? Yes. I can't even think about the mechanics. Okay, here we go. This is going to be beautiful. You may want to avert your eyes. Very ugly. Here we go. You ready? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Thank you. Sorry. Sorry. Okay. So you could see, it may have been hard for you to really see the difference. Right? Of course. Miles apart, right? Incredible. John, beautiful form, nice arc, perfect spiral, bullet right into the chest. Me, not so much. Okay, I want you to do the same thing. We're going to do it with a Nerf ball instead. And this time what I want you to do, I don't want you to release the ball. So what I want you to do is show us all of your art and beauty and muscle athleticism, but without releasing the ball. Whatever you do, don't let go of the ball. So one, two, three. Okay. A lovely, lovely form. You did great. That's all. Thank you so much. Oh, actually, one question. In general, as an expert on this stuff, when throwing a football, this is a complicated question, how important is the release?
Very.
He said very. Very important. The release. Fair to say that without the release, the ball isn't going anywhere, yes? John, everybody, big round of applause. The ball, without the release, isn't going anywhere. I know that sounds unbelievably obvious. I'm now Captain Obvious. I need a cape. Why do I show you this? What does this have to do with what we're talking about? The mind, our minds. The mind is the arm. And every time you come and listen to a teaching or read the Bible or read a book or do anything that involves a kind of intellectual processing, you are refining, strengthening, and coordinating the mechanics of the arm. There's great value in that. When trying to throw a football, that can be extremely powerful. To not exercise and refine the mind, you end up looking like what I looked like. But silence is the release. The practice of silence is when you learn to release the mind. The mind releases, and the ball is free. If you're looking for freedom, it is found only in the release. What that means is, even I, with an unrefined intellect in that sense, my arm unrefined and uncoordinated, the ball still flew through the air. But when John, with all of his muscles and all of his skill, if he didn't release the ball didn't go anywhere. This is the practice of silence. It is the practice of releasing ourselves into the heart of God and connecting with the source of life so that we actually have life to give. Does this make sense? You with me? Okay. We're going to practice some silence together now. And I'm going to give you just a few instructions for how to go about doing this. And then afterwards, I'll just say a few words and then we'll be done. So I'm going to begin. I'm going to ask you to sit up straight. Put both feet on the floor. Everything up until this point in the sermon has been about refining the mechanics of the arm. Now we're going to practice the release and hopefully experience the freedom. So sit up straight, comfortably. Become aware of the fact that you have a body. It's a wonderful gift you have. Just come to presence in your body. And now I'm going to ask you to close your eyes and turn your attention from the outside to the inside. That's the point of closing your eyes, is to turn awareness inward. I'm going to ask you to become aware of your breathing. You don't need to change it. You don't need to do anything with it. Just become aware of your breathing. Pay attention to the sensation just beneath the nose. As you breathe in, a slight cooling sensation. As you breathe out, maybe warmth. Just become aware of these things. when you're sitting silently, notice the way the mind is constantly conceptualizing this moment, constantly thinking and talking. You have an inner monologue and it's moving. Notice the way the mind will either fixate in the past and think about something that has happened, or wonder and wander into the future and get preoccupied with the future. You don't have to stop it. You don't have to judge it. Just notice it. Notice that this is what the mind does. This is what the mind is made for. And if you try to stop your mind, it's like trying to stop the lungs from breathing. It is its nature to think and wonder and ponder and move. That is its nature. The practice of silence is not stopping the mind. It is learning to gain distance from the mind. You're not trying to cut off your arm. You're trying to allow the arm to release. Sometimes the mind gets really sticky. We have to learn what it means to let it release and relax and be free. So sometimes the best thing to do is not to judge the mind, but simply to watch it dance and bounce around and move. Same way you might watch a monkey in a cage bouncing around the inside of the cage. Our task here is to learn to step out of the cage and simply watch it. You don't have to judge it. You don't have to stop it. Just gain distance from it and let it dance. If you find yourself inside the cage dancing and bouncing around with it because it really looks like a lot of fun, the mind, and you want to bounce around and dance around with it, that's okay. What I'm going to ask you to do is exhale gently and fully. And on the exhale, that is a symbol of the release. In that moment, you let go of the ball. In that moment, you step outside of the cage and you learn to watch the monkey bounce around again. The practice of silence is all about gaining distance from your thoughts, the same way that a plane, when it takes off, gains distance from the ground. The cars are still there. They just become smaller and less consequential. Your thoughts are still there. They're just not as important. Your feelings, everything that's going on around. So, for the next 2 minutes, we're going to practice silence corporately and allow yourself to watch the mind and practice the release through your exhale. Amen. Now, a few things to keep in mind if this is a practice that interests you, if you're feeling like you need to discover that kind of inner place of the connection, the experience of God, where you actually taste that God. And by the way, the moment you exhale and release, even in that 1 second, the connection is made. This is not complicated. This is not rocket science. It's very simple. It's hard to believe how simple it actually is, and it's hard to pay attention that you actually make the connection every time you release. But you are. That's the gift. That's what God gives. It's just the way it is. I don't know why it is, but it is. Now, if you're a person who's tried this stuff in the past and it hasn't worked and you can't stand it, kind of like me, the thing that freed me, that helped me fall in love with the power of this practice, was when I learned something. There is no such thing as success or failure when you're practicing silence. Those categories don't exist. And that means that if you're sitting there and you had 1,000,005 thoughts in your 2 minutes, and every exhale you were trying to release and release and release and release, that is not worse than someone who did one exhale, released, and was completely in serene peace for the whole 2 minutes. That is not the point of this practice. Over a lifetime, it doesn't get better or easier. What does change is not the 5 minutes or the up to 20 minutes that you might want to do this. Those moments, depending on your life circumstances, will either be frenetic and painful and challenging, and you'll wonder why you wasted your time, and other times you'll be like, oh my gosh, I'm a master at silence. The point is not the 20 minutes. The point is how you begin to experience life the rest of the hours of the day. You begin to live from the very source of life. The connection is made, and you are free to begin offering life for the world. You all have been wonderful. Thank you for your time and having me as your guest. There are joy boxes in the back and online.